The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the National Geographic Magazine and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today, we need to make a connection. It concerns the Armchair Traveler program that aired on September 14th of this year. At that time, we read Charles Fisherman's story, The Great Moon Rush, from the September 2025 issue of National Geographic. Now, at the time we recorded the program, we were prepared to read Fisherman's article in a couple of parts. Unfortunately, I experienced some medical issues which prevented me from recording part two until now. So, we will now read part two of The Great Moon Rush. And before we begin, I will highlight what we've learned so far, just in case I need to catch some of you up. As Fishman points out, the moon is about to be a very busy place, with 84 announced missions between now and 2030. Not all of those by the United States, of course, but many of them are. Now, in the article, we learned that NASA wants to return to the moon to develop the lunar landscape to suit human needs. Essential to this plan is using lunar soil, known as regolith, to obtain the necessary minerals needed to establish a moon base. Now, once this happens, it becomes the foundation for a lunar economy that will sustain human life and allow extended days, or stays, I should say, that will be required for future space exploration. Now, of special interest is the lunar South Pole. Now, why? Well, scientists believe that's the region where we're going to find water in the soil, which is needed to sustain life and provide other resources that will be needed for a space colony. So, we're going to now turn to part two today, and we're going to start by reading a couple of short paragraphs from the end of part one, talking about mining this water, if you will, and then going from there. In practice, the water trapped in the permanently dark South Pole craters will be insanely difficult to mine. Blocked from radio contact, with steep sides and uneven bottoms and interior temperatures of 20 degrees Kelvin, that's minus 424 degrees Fahrenheit, impossible for astronauts to explore safely, but also impossible for the moment for robots to explore, let alone mine and bring up to human bases. A thriving lunar economy will rely on water as much as regolith. It could well be the pivot on which the lunar surface, or lunar future, I should say, turns. The question of lunar water is on the agenda of every company and space agency. Every moon mission is involving people aimed at the South Pole, including Artemis III, NASA's first effort since 1972 to land people on the moon. Most of the uncrewed missions to test out rovers and solar panels and robots are also aimed at the South Pole. Many will be looking for evidence of water as part of their work. Now, finding it or not will be a powerful indicator of what lunar future might look like. So there we go. That kind of capsulizes everything we learned in part one. Now on to part two. In March 1966, 3 years before Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin would land on the moon, NASA received a sobering report from engineers and scientists at the Grumman Aircraft Engineering Corporation, which was building the Apollo Lunar Module, and colleagues at Arthur D. Little, a Cambridge, Massachusetts consulting firm. The engineers had been asked a simple question: how much would the Apollo missions pollute the moon just by landing there? The 206-page scientific analysis contains an astonishing revelation right at the start. The moon, it turns out, has a naturally occurring atmosphere. It's very thin, but lunar gravity is strong enough to attract and hold a tenuous veil of gas molecules. The Apollo 11 lunar module, when it settled into Tranquility Base atop a plume of rocket exhaust, would deliver almost as many gas molecules to the moon as the lunar atmosphere already contained. Indeed, it would turn out that each time we sent a lunar module, we delivered an entirely new atmosphere of gas molecules to the moon from the rocket plume of landing, along with gases vented from the cabin, and even, this is their word now, farts vented from the astronauts' spacesuits. Wow. Well, which is to say the very act of exploring the moon pollutes it. Now, the moon is 14.6 million square miles, or about twice the land area of the United States and Canada. All that land is empty now and almost completely untouched. As we know from earthly experience, the time to plan for its protection as a natural resource is now, or our most ambitious science plans for the moon may be thwarted. That's exactly the problem that Caltech astrophysicist Nivedita Mahesh is worried about. But the pollution she most worries about isn't the typical sort. Mahesh studies star formation at the earliest moments of the universe. It's an epoch we call the cosmic dawn, she says, when the very first stars turned on. To understand how the very first stars formed, scientists have to listen to the signals from the universe when it was only 100 million or 200 million years old. The equivalent of understanding the life of a 100-year-old by looking back to when that person was 9 months old. In astrophysics, the only way to listen that far back is to use advanced telescopes. On Earth, you can't. Between the atmosphere and the noise all our own electromagnetic emissions make, it's just too noisy. The quietest place in the solar system turns out to be the far side of the moon. Mahesh is part of a group of scientists and engineers working on the design of FarView, an extraordinary radio telescope that would take advantage of the moon's radio quiet with 100,000 interlinked individual antennas to listen to the birth of the universe. The project aims to rely on the technology currently under development on the commercial side to have FarView build itself on the moon using robotic rovers to mount regolith and extrude antenna wires. Like her colleagues at Rocket and Mining Companies, she talks with excitement and a sense of momentum, even inevitability. But a vibrant commercial economy on the moon is both the good news and the bad news for science. It could lay the foundation for FarView or make it impossible. Nokia sent a rover to the moon in early 2025 to test out how lunar cell phone transmission worked. That's great, says Mahesh. Improving communication is critical, but the lunar cell service can interfere with studying those faint primordial radio signals if not properly shielded. There's a danger, Mahesh says, that the radio transmissions of routine moon operations will spoil or contaminate the radio quiet environment. The time to safeguard that quiet is now. Mahesh speaks from experience. Elon Musk's Starlink version 2 satellites launched into Earth orbit in 2023 to beam internet service from space have blotted out the ability to listen to some signals from space, literally blinding some key Earthside radio telescopes. Currently, there are no binding international agreements for conservation on the moon, but new ideas are percolating to start safeguarding the moon against this type of degradation, scientifically and culturally. The British planetary scientist Ian Crawford has suggested an international agreement right now to set aside the moon's North Pole permanently as an area protected from human activity, a Yellowstone Park for the moon so we can always return to an unspoiled lunar region if we needed to, for science or spirituality, for that matter. Now, another idea, a set of international rules that would require all development on the moon to be invisible to the naked eye from Earth, so no one will look up at night and see bright construction lights or red mining operation strobes flashing from the moon. As the philosopher and space exploration ethicist Brian Green of Santa Clara University points out, everyone who has ever lived on Earth who can see has seen the moon. It captures your attention from the time you're old enough to look at it until the time you die. You can't just mess with something like that. The moon is also sacred to many cultures, now and historically. In 2024, the Diné of the Navajo Nation objected to a private company's mission to land cremated human remains on the moon, calling it an act of desecration. As it happens, that lander failed to reach the moon. Now is the time to put protection in place, says Crawford, because it's the earliest moment. The easiest moment. No one's commercial interest will be hurt. Mahesh is already in meetings planning future missions where she advocates for strong radio quiet controls, and there are slow-moving UN-sponsored talks on related topics like an air traffic control system for the moon. So everyone knows where everyone else is, and allocating radio frequencies and establishing rules for rescuing astronauts in danger. The press of lunar activity will push them forward. Nations have hundreds of years of norms and rules about managing ocean resources, and management of the moon could well look similar. The distance might seem to impart impunity to rogue behavior. Who exactly is going to race to the lunar North Pole to issue citations against those not respecting a park boundary? Well, for the imaginable future, any company or nation or science institution operating on the moon will be operating from Earth, which is where the enforcement leverage comes from and where any sanctions can be imposed. And one of the unspoken rules of the high seas is that presence matters. The U.S. has 11 aircraft carrier strike groups for the seven seas. The Chinese Navy has added ships steadily in the past decade and now has more warships than the U.S. Navy. The same principle will be vividly true on the empty moon, now empty moon, I should say. And this moon race is about an adventure, an opportunity, science, but also presence. And whoever's activity is dominant on the moon will most powerfully influence its rules and shape its future. Well, going to the moon to live and work will demand the combination of hubris and humility that other crazy human enterprises have required. Transcontinental Railroad and the trek to the poles, the invention of the Internet and original moon landings themselves. We are certainly underestimating the consequences, as we did with each of those projects. The moon is going to be harder in reality than everyone hopes. Since 2018, there have been 15 missions to put landers on the surface of the moon from a range of countries and companies. Only six succeeded, a 60% failure rate with 21st century technology. One pioneering company, Intuitive Machines, became the first private company to soft land a spacecraft on the moon and not crash, something only five nations have done. Intuitive Machines did this twice, stunning achievements for a small company, and both landers survived their arrivals on the moon, but they weren't able to perform their missions for a simple, sobering reason. In each case, as it landed on the uneven terrain near the moon's south pole, the spacecraft toppled over, rendering it mostly useless after years of work and tens of millions of dollars in investment. If the moon proves harder than companies like Intuitive Machines hope, their investors could get exhausted. If the promise of water fades, so could investor enthusiasm. We could spend two decades trying to make life on the moon work, trying to spark a self-sustaining lunar economy, and it could all peter out, leaving the moon littered with remnants of what could have been moon bases, much the way terrestrial development stall, leaving rebar sticking up from half-finished walls. Those would stay on the moon, a testament to our failures, for millions of years. Think about that picture it just painted. Well, indeed, the moon is about to be a very busy place, with 84 announced international and commercial missions just between now and 2030. Economics will ultimately drive what happens after. But what's so striking is a different motivation expressed equally by the entrepreneurs, the engineers, the scientists, the astrophysicists like Joseph Silk and Nivedita Mahesh. They all wonder. Our fascination and appreciation for the moon are built on wonder. You can feel the wonder here on Earth when you step outside on a summer evening and a full moon is rising, now low and large and shining on the horizon. You can feel the wonder and the hypnotic appeal of the pictures from the moon's surface. You can hear the wonder in the voices of the Apollo astronauts from the surface. Wonder is driving the age of new moon as much as opportunism. Well, far view, rather, is a stretch, as is the life-spotting hyper-telescope, but no more than the Apollo missions or the Internet or the Manhattan Project. Mahesh hopes far view's team will see some test radio antennas on the moon as soon as next year, with a larger array as soon as 2030. To install 100,000 antennas, she says, you first have to do one. Understanding the astrophysics of the 13.8-billion-year-old universe has tremendous urgency for Mahesh, driven by both the opportunity the moment presents and the wonder. How could we not explain the origins of the universe if we have the ability to do it? We have to complete the picture, says Mahesh. Don't we want to know where the first star came from? We are stardust. Don't we want to know where we came from? This is the only way to do it. What a story that is, huh? Well, we're going to return to Earth and visit Lahaina on the Hawaiian island of Oahu. Now, you may recall it was only a couple of years ago that a devastating wildfire consumed the historic community, forcing residents to relocate until the town could be rebuilt. As the rebuilding continues, it has become integrated with another big issue, the future of Hawaii's tourism industry. Writer Sarah Kahahulani is the president of the Washington Post Creator Network. She also is the author of Kuleana, a story of family, land, and legacy in old Hawaii. In October 4th, 2025 issue of the Post, Ms. Kahahulani wrote an article headlined, "Can Tourism Be Respectful? Native Hawaiians Have a Plan." And the editors provided a subhead that kind of gives us an overview of what this is about. Hawaii wants visitors to appreciate native culture, but larger economic forces pose a threat to the what's being called the regenerative revolution. So keep that in mind. And we're going to begin with two decades ago, Noah Keola Ryan took a job as a hiking tour guide with a big company on Oahu, only to find out it was a sham. The company took photos of waterfalls from another island and touted them on its website. He'd have to explain to disappointed visitors that Oahu didn't actually have many waterfalls, but they still have a nice time. And sometimes he'd overhear other tour guides tell jokes that made fun of the Hawaiian language. What I saw in the industry was a lot of tour operators treated Hawaiian culture as kind of a joke, just entertainment. It was a conducted solely for profit enterprise, Ryan said. I always told myself if I were to do this, I'd make the culture the focus. Ryan, who is native Hawaiian, is now doing just that. He operates his own business, North Shore Eco Tours of Oahu, guiding small groups through private lands with cultural insights from an insider. And he's finding that's just what certain tourists are seeking. For the past 5 years, Ryan and other native Hawaiians have led a larger movement in Hawaii to correct the ills of over-tourism. During the pandemic, the state hired a new group of native Hawaiian leaders to oversee some of the biggest tourism agencies and marketing budgets. The idea is regenerative tourism. It's a buzzword, but one with real substance, creating opportunities for local residents to benefit from tourism beyond low-wage hotel and airport jobs is a priority. So is increasing in-state tourism business ownership and addressing the cost of living crisis. Visitors are encouraged to get more acquainted with the culture and, in turn, more invested in local communities. But over the past several months, a political scandal in the state's tourism agency, declining visitor numbers, and a grim economic forecast have been testing the state's commitment to regenerative tourism. At stake is the state's $20 billion industry, its biggest economic driver. The real hula. On a recent Thursday night on the upstairs patio of the Hyatt Regency Waikiki, a group of tourists filled their plates with sushi and a traditional Hawaiian dish called lalau, a salty pork wrapped in taro leaves, while waiting for a hula show to begin as the sun set over the ocean. The performance was different from most, but only a discerning eye would notice. There were no fast, hip-shaking Tahitian dancers. No men spewed fire from their mouths. No tourists were asked to come on stage to wear a coconut bra. Instead, dancers from local Halu performed modern Awana and traditional Kahiko hula to a live local band. To one familiar song, the MC invited members of the audience to get up and join in and dance hula, which would be more common at a local luau. It's one example of a program funded by the state's regenerative tourism effort known as Kilohana, which is intended to introduce more authentic hula in the heart of Waikiki. The hotel employs dancers and musicians who share the culture, not just entertain. The visitors see Hawaii hula, not Tahitian or Samoan or other dancing. Now, this is all taking place at the Nilai Alahu Aloha Luau Show at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki. And the man responsible for this is Kehua Lewis, a chief executive of the Council of Native Hawaiian Advancement. He calls this regenerative. He says we're reclaiming our culture. Hawaii's leaders are pushing for a new balance between its 9 million annual visitors, which the state depends on, and the pressure that those visitors can put on Hawaii's infrastructure, environment, and rising cost of living for many locals. In May, Hawaii Governor Josh Green, a Democrat, signed a landmark bill into law that enacted a new visitor's green tax onto all hotel and cruise ships that would go to pay for climate, such as protecting against another wildfire. Starting next year, it's expected to generate $100 million annually, money that can be used to help eroding beaches and respond to the next climate disaster. Earlier this year, Kealina Resort on Oahu's west side announced partnership with the National Council to devote nearly 18 acres to fostering a deeper connection to the heritage of Hawaii for visitors. In the same area, known for its man-made lagoons and resort hotels with $600 per night rooms, developers plan to construct a new Atlantis resort that would reportedly cost $2 billion. Atlantis, which has properties in the Bahamas and Dubai, would be neighbors with Disney's Aulani Resort. Now, can Disney, Atlantis, and an authentic native Hawaiian experience not only coexist, but work together? This type of transformation doesn't happen overnight, said John DeFries, the first native Hawaiian to be selected to lead the Hawaii Tourism Authority, who spearheaded the regenerative tourism effort during the pandemic. He has faith in the long view. I don't expect everybody to get it, but it starts with leadership. If we, and that's malama, which means to take care of the environment will malama us. Politics hurting tourism. The Native Council, a nonprofit group, won a $27 million marketing contract in 2023 from the State Tourism Agency. Lewis said the group has used the money to advertise local programs like the Kilohana Luau on Waikiki and to promote local businesses from fruit stands to eco tours. We spend a little too much time focusing on the tropical isle destination, the sun and surf, said Tyler Gomes, chief administrator for the council. Now that there are much deeper destinations that offer the same things, we have to home in on what makes us unique, he adds. And yet the embrace of regenerative tourism is already being tested by economic headwinds. Visitor numbers across Hawaii have dipped 5% compared with a year ago, according to a September report from state economists, and international visitors have dropped significantly from Japan with the decline of the yen. The report forecasts the state falling into a mild recession by the end of 2025, and the visitor spending expected to drop by more than $600 million. The tourism industry has been hit due to tariffs, a slowdown in global travel, and political backlash from normally strong markets such as Canada, whose residents aren't as keen to visit the U.S. right now. The Hawaii Tourism Authority, which manages marketing efforts, has seen a shakeup following allegations of racism, a toxic work environment, and improper spending among executives at the agency. Green, the governor, is reshaping the authority with a newly appointed advisory board. That leaves the state's entire tourism strategy, marketing budget, and future of its regenerative tourism effort up in the air. Amidst the evolving landscape of our tourism authority, let's hope that decision makers continue to champion regenerative tourism, Lewis said. Going backwards should not be an option. Rebuilding with intention. It's been 2 years since the fires devastated Maui. Today, construction trucks hum through some of the reopened streets of Lahaina, where for miles, blocks upon blocks of blackened streetscape remain gutted where homes, businesses, and hotels once stood. Wooden frames of houses are going up, dotting the landscape, but progress is slow. Most of what once was Lahaina Town is now a collection of flat concrete slabs waiting to serve as future structural foundations. Some parcels are filled with gray rock gravel, evidence that the site has been cleared of toxic materials. Waves roll over the destroyed harbor in the distance. About 20% of Maui County's housing stock are vacation homes, compared with cities like Los Angeles or London, which are about 1% or 3%. The county council is considering Bill 9, a measure that would convert half the county's 13,000 vacation housing units, mostly condos originally constructed for residents, to become available to rent to long-term renters in a phased approach over several years. The condo owners, a large majority of whom live off-island, opposed the bill and testified that the change would harm their real estate investment. But some local residents argue tourism is already down and the status quo means fewer residents will be able to serve tourists anyway. Shannon Yai, who testified before the county in June, says she lost her home in the fire and she's tired of seeing family have to move away due to unaffordable housing while Maui's vacation rentals sit empty. The bill is not anti-business, she said. It's pro-community. To many in Hawaii, the Maui condo controversy is the peak example of the state's challenge to find the right balance between serving tourists and its local residents. People think we're an anti-tourism group. We're not, said Jordan Ruitas, a founder of Lahaina Strong, whose group helped successfully lobby Congress for $1.6 billion in disaster recovery funds last year. We're pro-quality of life for local residents, she said. One new idea to emerge from the ashes of Lahaina is to create a cultural corridor downtown that would impact people to Hawaii's history in a way, or connect people to Hawaii's history in a way that didn't exist before the fires. Local residents have pushed for rebuilding the historic Makuula, a small island that once served as a royal residence and a retreat for King Kamehameha, and that was surrounded by Mokohihina, a small pond and a mausoleum for members of the royal family. Waters that fed the pond were later diverted to irrigate sugar cane plantations, and more recently the site was filled to become a recreational park. Kia Amokuku Pukapu, who leads the Na Aikini o Maui Community Foundation, a native Hawaiian group, lost his building on Front Street in the fire. It was full of cultural artifacts, but now he has a vision to bring Moku'ula back as the center of Lahaina and back to its roots. He wants a place where tourists can learn about the history of Hawaii before European contact and its days during the kingdom. He envisions the original green space where local children can engage in an annual Makahiki festival of traditional Hawaiian games and sports. It's time we start focusing on what's really important, which is the cultural tradition, the history, because we buried this town literally, Kapu said. There's nothing in here that reflected the kingdom of Hawaii. Both the governor and mayor support dedicating funds to build Moku'ula, but it's unclear now just how much of those funds allocated by Congress can actually be spent on the effort and when. The project has been given approval to move ahead, but the first priority for the county is to secure and build more homes and for residents displaced by the fire. Quite an interesting picture painted there about what's going on in Lahaina. And I have to say, with just a few minutes, less than a couple of minutes left in the show, just a personal note, my wife and I enjoyed the pleasure in 2017 of visiting Lahaina as part of our trip to three of the Hawaiian islands. Quite an amazing place, and the thing that will always stick in our minds is the banyan tree that we have a picture of us taken under. It was destroyed and eventually felled by the fire, but it was a beautiful tree and a beautiful community, and all this before the fire. Ironically, at the same time, Kilauea, which we also visited, was erupting, so something's always happening in Hawaii. Nature's got the course. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of our episode of Armchair Traveler for today. Hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Armchair Travel available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, give us a call at 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.